We are rebroadcasting one of our original episodes this week that certainly didn't get many views early on, but is a great episode chock full of insights. Tune in next week for a brand new episode of the Shipshape Podcast.
Welcome aboard the Shipshape Podcast, your ultimate destination for marine wisdom and expertise. Our skilled crew, comprised of top boating journalists and experts, is committed to delivering informative and captivating content week after week. We're eager to connect with and learn from our fellow mariners, and we encourage you to share our podcast with your friends. Remember, word of mouth is our lifeblood. And if you enjoy an episode, please leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. By doing so, you're helping us forge a robust community of mariners who can learn, collaborate, and exchange their experiences out on the water.
Today on the Shipshape Podcast, we have Jordy St. John. Jordy is the business engagement manager of the Maine Island Trail Association. He's also the owner and operator of Merritt Island Oysters. How's it going, Jordy?
Good. How are you doing today, Merrill?
Pretty good. Where are you at?
I am currently talking to you from the Maine Island Trail Association office, which is in Portland, Maine. We're right here on the harbor above the Maine Yacht Center. So I'm looking out at Casco Bay.
Oh, Casco Bay. It's one of those destinations that every sailor tries to get out to in the summer, huh?
Yeah, lots of good islands to visit here.
So you've done a bunch of boat-related things. You've also done software. So how long have you been in the maritime industry in this space?
Yeah, so I actually grew up spending the month of July in Mystic, Connecticut, where I used to sail down to Mystic, Connecticut. My first job was teaching sailing to younger kids, and then spending the month of August on Cape Small in Small Point, Maine, and I used to sail here. So I grew up, both my parents were Outward Bound instructors. Both my mom and my dad had their captain's licenses, so we spent the summer always on the water. And then when I was in college, I was a launch tender and driving people back and forth from the dock to the boat. Got to practice my docking skills quite a bit. And then after college, I got my captain's license and started doing some captaining as well.
So with the captain's license, what do you think are the things that you need to learn if you are a captain? What are the top qualities that you need to have in order to be a really good captain?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing with doing the captaining is really being aware of everything that's going on around you. So kind of having your head on a swivel, being able to quickly process and think through things logically, staying calm. I used to, when I was captaining, it was here in Portland Harbor, which is a pretty busy harbor. We get cruise ships, we have the ferries back and forth, we've got a lot of pleasure craft. And so it's really just kind of being aware of your surroundings at all times. I think clearly you have to take, quite a bit of, you have to have sea time. And I took a course in order to get my license. And the information that you learn in those courses is definitely very, very valuable. So I would recommend anybody that's interested in getting into boating, even just to do, a one-day safety course, because there really is some great rules of the road and information you can learn.
Yeah, absolutely. So Merrill's already mentioned that you had a software background and then made a bit of a shift. Could you talk us through a little bit why you decided to do that and how that kind of came about?
Yeah, for sure. So I was, even prior to doing the software, I was captaining, and I was actually a Nordic cross-country ski coach of a Division I ski team up in at Bates College, which is here in Maine. And then the software job kind of came along, and I ended up spending just over 9 years doing that. I was the director of a couple different departments, and it was always great people to work with. And my colleagues, the clientele was really nice, but it was never something that I had a strong passion for, software for commercial real estate. And so after those kind of 9 years, this position at the Maine Island Trail Association opened up, and that was to be able to do business engagement. And my background of having a nautical background, which was appealing to the organization. Plus I had, traveled a bunch to cities all around the US, always having, meetings and training commercial class A office space on how to use software. So I'd had a lot of interpersonal skills and being able to kind of connect with these different businesses. So it was a nice fit for me to be able to really go to an organization whose mission is about access to islands as well as stewardship and actually cleaning up those islands. So it was a mission that I was easily able to get behind, but also then be able to still develop relationships with the business community and being able to really leverage those. So it was a nice fit for me. And I jumped at that one pretty quickly to be able to get out of software for commercial real estate to go to the Maine Island Trail Association.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of combining your sort of passion, isn't it? You know, your love for the water with also the kind of commercial side of things. That must be a really nice combination for you.
Yeah. And, you know, while I was doing over the 9 years of doing the software for commercial real estate, I really missed being on the water, because prior to doing that was when I had been the full-time captain. And that's when I actually started the oyster farm. I didn't have much free time, but I had two young kids at that point and was full-time, the director of a department. But on the side, I started doing my Merritt Island oysters only as a way to get back out on the water more. So now that I work full-time for MITA, I actually feel like my oyster farm is a fun thing to do on the side, but it was really more of a need for me to be able to get back out on the water. And that's why I started that farm back in 2017.
Yeah. And I gather that your children also help out.
Begrudgingly, I get them out there. Yeah. I think it's a great way to kind of show them, hard work, but also environmentally, how it can play into helping the environment. I think people maybe or maybe don't know that oysters are filter feeders. A full-size oyster can filter, which is about 3 inches, can filter 50 gallons of water a day. So they actually filter and purify the water. And I think my kids kind of realize, hey, this is a good thing that dad's doing, although they don't always love to get dragged out and get covered with biofouling and oyster poop and everything else when we're out there cleaning them.
I assume they don't like the taste of oysters.
You know what? My 8-year-old will slurp an oyster. My 10-year-old will not. And it's quite funny that my wife does not really like oysters, even though we have, 40,000 of them that we have access to. So.
Well, maybe that's why she doesn't like them.
Yeah.
Being a person who works, as an ice cream tester, doesn't want to ever eat ice cream ever again because it's all they ever see, right?
True. Yes, exactly. Although I think if I was an ice cream tester, I'd still keep on eating my ice cream. So.
And oyster flavored ice cream hasn't caught on yet then.
Yeah, exactly. No, not yet. Not yet. Give it time. You never know. There's now kelp and everything. So who knows?
We were reading on your blog about some beer that was brewed with oyster shells.
Yep. A local brewery here, which as people may or may not know, we have quite a few microbreweries here in Maine. And one of them took a number of oyster shells, they crushed them up, and then they let them ferment over time, and they made a pretty good stout out of them. So yeah, we got to be part of that project.
Now, I know that, I've seen it a lot recently, this move to ocean farming. Mm-hmm. And over time, it seems like it's going to become more and more of a thing. Have you been noticing an increase in the amount of oyster farms that are being set up?
Yeah. So I started mine in 2017, which was just kind of on the verge of this more and more people getting into it. I wouldn't say I was, an early adopter. There's certainly been people farming, aquaculture farming along the coast of Maine, really for the last 40, 50 years. And of course, before then as well. But the number of people that got into it, especially over the last 4 years, I would say, and then even with the pandemic, it's been a huge increase. And, I would say there's also, it seems to be now with more and more people getting into it, that there's actually quite a bit of collaboration as well. One of the things that we did was I helped kind of form what we call the New Meadows River Shellfish Cooperative. And that's 11 different farms that work together to try to, create really good oysters, try to help marketing. Oysters are very much like beer and wine, right? That people want to try. They have different flavor profiles. They want to try Merritt Island oysters. They want to try Cape Small oysters. They want to try Fur to Farm oysters. So even if they're within a similar region, people really like to be able to try them because they do have different flavor profiles. So it's much more like in the wine world where you know, it's kind of regionally based, but you want to try them from the different actual growers, which has been a nice way to collaborate.
That's fascinating. I had no idea about different flavors of oysters. I mean, to the uninitiated, is there any way you can articulate what your oysters are like compared to others?
Yeah. So in the wine world, you know how they call it terroir. In the aquaculture world, we call it miroir. And it's just because the oysters are filter feeders that they take on kind of their own flavor profile. So as an oyster farmer, I have the ability to kind of help shape an oyster, the actual look, the cup, the size of the oyster. That's one of the things that I can control. I can't really at all control the flavor of the oyster. Clearly, I'm not adding anything into the ocean. That's something I don't have any flavor over. I would say that mine have a little bit of a briny start when it hits your palate, and then more of a sweet finish to it, is the description that I tend to give my oysters.
Are they, in terms of, obviously you've mentioned that they're filter feeders and they can help with, you know, cleaning the ocean. What about in terms of if they're in super polluted environments, though? Presumably that's an issue. If there's nasty stuff in the water, that will also affect the oysters, I guess.
Yeah. So here in Maine, it's a pretty highly regulated industry through the Department of Marine Resources. You have to apply for where you're going to be able to actually set up your oyster farm. It goes through to the Department of Marine Resources. It gets signed off on by the Army Corps of Engineers. And there's a lot of prohibited zones where you cannot grow oysters. And that said, they're also using, you may have heard of it, the Billion Oyster Project in New York City, where they're actually trying to use oysters to help clean in the Hudson River and down in around the Battery. So they're actually, those ones are not for consumption.
Presumably there must be a point at which...
Exactly. And they, you know, they'll actually test and they'll close us down. So if we get more than 2 inches of rain in 24 hours, they'll automatically close things down. They're constantly testing. If there's what's called PSP, paralytic shellfish poisoning, or any type of other diseases in the water, you know, they're always testing, and they send out kind of daily emails to let us know if we can be harvesting or not harvesting our product. And different shellfish get shut down easier. So like scallops, if somebody's doing those, or clams, they might get shut down quicker than, let's say, the American oyster. And the European oyster might get shut down before the American oyster, just because they know how each shellfish processes, you know, the water through their as they filter.
How hardy are oysters anyway? Like how does the impacts and kind of the temperature change of the water affect oysters?
That is a great question, Meryl. So oysters, I would say in general, especially the, so I grow what's called Crassoterra virginica. It's the eastern oyster, basically. And they're actually quite hardy. You know, I can flip my cages over for 24 hours, have the oysters up out of the water. It'll knock off and kill a lot of the biofouling, but the oysters will live, flip them back over into grow mode, and they can keep growing. That said, like in the wintertime, all of a sudden, you know, I'll get 15% mortality on my farm. And it's just that they get buried too far in the mud or different things. So they're typically very hardy, but then at the same time, you know, you just sometimes you have to scratch your head and wonder why you lost some. We call oyster math is kind of funny math. You plan on buying a certain amount of seed to get going, and then some die. You just have to kind of account for mortality within the oyster and aquaculture world.
Does climate change have are there implications associated with climate change in terms of water temperature?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Georgia. So yes, basically with the slightly, everybody knows the Gulf of Maine is warming, one of the more rapidly warming bodies of water. And for the oysters, they grow quicker in warmer water, right? There's more phytoplankton, there's more nutrients for them to be able to feed off of. It's warmer water. They have less stressors on them. So they can actually grow quicker. That said, the downside is that you do end up with more diseases. You end up with more of this paralytic shellfish poisoning. You end up with other types of algae blooms and other things that, you know, red tide, which we didn't used to have much of here in Maine. And so that will actually shut down being able to harvest. It will also stress the oysters in certain ways. So it's definitely a give and take. We would rather not have it warm. A cold water oyster is, you know, they take a little bit longer to grow, but they have a very different flavor profile than, let's say, one from down south that can grow out in 1 year because it's warmer and they can grow a lot quicker.
Cool. How long does it take for an oyster to reach the point in which you can harvest it?
Yep. So typically speaking, market size oysters are 2¾ to 3 inches in size is what most people like to see. That's kind of your like cocktail oyster on the half shell, if you will. And that the general time frame is 2 years. Some will make it a tiny bit quicker. Some will make it a tiny bit slower. But it's yeah, it's really two full growing seasons is kind of for the most part where most of them sit. I would say half my oysters within the 2 years are just about ready, and definitely half of them I'll overwinter and let them plump up for one more winter and then start selling them off in the springtime.
So I come from the world of luxury yachting. That's my, my work is.
Yeah.
If only I did. But yeah. Anyway, obviously oysters are associated very much with luxury and expense.
Yep.
Why is that? Are they expensive to grow?
They're not expensive to grow.
And are
they're still
there, basically, is my question.
Yeah. So oysters are not super expensive to grow. They are time consuming for sure. They take a little bit of love and handling. Georgia, that's a great question. It's always kind of been, well, what's really interesting is there's a book about the history of the New York and the New York oyster and how back, 150 years ago or more, that was not necessarily a high class thing. Everybody ate oysters, there was just unlimited amounts of them. And then it's become more and more of this kind of allure where it is a little bit more high class, sexy oysters. So I don't know what the transition was.
But are there more oysters around than there were?
There's more people growing oysters now, but there were naturally more oysters around back in the day. I mean, ships used to go aground on oyster reefs in New York City Harbor back in the day.
Whoa.
Okay. Interesting.
And that's part of what that Billion Oyster Project is trying to do, is reestablish kind of oyster reefs because of their filtering capabilities.
So getting into the Maine Island Trail Association, they basically do management of over, 200 of the islands in Maine. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what the mission is of MITA?
Yeah. So Maine Island Trail Association, as you alluded to, fondly known as MITA, our mission is really around stewardship and access. So what we do as an organization is we do provide access to, it's now 255 sites along the entire coast of Maine. Now, most of those predominantly are islands. We also do have some mainland sites they're on the coast, actually on the mainland, but also water sites. What we do as an organization is it was formed in 1988, and it is literally a handshake agreement with the local landowner. So the way it was formed was a guy named Dave Getchell back in 1988 kind of was tasked to see, what islands the state owned. At that point, he got the idea of kind of this recreational water trail where boaters could, be able to, at that point, really cruise and powerboat along the coast of Maine, and have places where with small boats, right, be able to stop in. He was a powerboater himself. And then since that, we've really grown over that was in 1988, so the last 34 years, we've really grown the stewardship component. So we have our own boats that we use. They're 8 Luns. So that's an 18-foot aluminum boat that we use on trailers. We trail them up and down the coast, and then we put in and we go out to islands. Last year, we had over 1,000 different people volunteer to help us. And we go out and we remove marine debris. So, it's really focused on that stewardship, actually removing marine debris, caring for the islands, and then being able to actually actively use them. So you look at that beautiful island here in Maine and you kind of wonder, hey, is somebody going to get really upset that I'm potentially stepping foot on their island, or are they going to be glad that I'm here? So we provide the information about where you can anchor, where you can go ashore, where are campsites if it's day use only. And of these, mostly island, but also some mainland sites, it's about a third of them are state owned. About a third of them are owned by other nonprofits, other organizations, and then about a third of them are actually privately owned. And we just get a handshake agreement with the landowner that says, yeah, you can use my island, knowing that for the landowner, MITA now we're a membership-based organization. We have 9,500 members. And knowing that those members are actually going to care for it. So they really follow this whole idea of leave no trace, leaving it in better condition than when you came. And it's really appealing to a landowner who maybe doesn't get out to their island all the time, but knowing that it's actually going to be cared for, because trash doesn't care what island it floats up onto. And that's where we've really been able to have this nice cycle of access to more places because we're creating and doing more stewardship because we have more members to be able to do that. So it's this nice kind of cycle of stewardship, access, and membership.
It's interesting to hear about water trails, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone's so familiar with kind of like the Appalachian Trail or the PCT or that type of stuff, but there's the Great Loop and, you know, there's also the Main Island Trail. So these landowners that have kind of come on board with you, they've seen the work that you've done. And obviously they were like, oh, let's do this. How have you seen in terms of trash, and has that substantially like increased over time or?
Yeah, you know, and the one thing I always like to try to be clear of, because, you know, we do call it the Main Island Trail and it is a recreational water trail, but there's no, it's very different in that there's no right or wrong way to do it. Even if you say you wanted to, what some people will call like, you know, do the entire coast and stop in at islands, there's no right or wrong way to do it. It could be a day trip out to an island that's 5 minutes from your dock, let's say. So, you know, when it comes to kind of the trail, we refer to it fondly as the trail, but there's no right or wrong way to do any of it. It's just that kind of being able to access. And then in terms of the actual increase in marine debris, we've definitely have seen an increase, you know, certainly with the amount of microplastics in the water. And you know, we don't actually go out and like, you know, we're not skimming the water and cleaning up stuff that's in the actual water column. What we do is we try to clean up everything that's then come ashore. And we'll do more than just the islands that are on the Main Island Trail. Like we'll work with other organizations that maybe, you know, own other islands, and we'll partner up to help them because we have the boats, we have the actual stewardship team on our staff, and then we also have the volunteers. So we do more than just our 255 as well, just because it makes a lot of sense to partner up and do those cleanups. So yeah, to answer your question, Meryl, I would say there has been an increase in trash, but then again, I feel like people are becoming more aware of the whole idea of leave no trace and trying to, you know, clean up after yourselves as well. So that does help.
I got to ask, what is the weirdest thing that you've seen wash ashore?
So on some of the islands, especially when Maida first kind of got going, you know, a lot of islands, you know, maybe were either owned privately or publicly, but locals knew about, you know, what islands that they were just going to go on to. And, you know, they would have parties. We have found, like, I literally just got a text from one of our stewardship managers who, you know, hauled probably a 12-foot aluminum boat that was, you know, had a huge hole in the bottom of it. And he dragged it off of an island just today. He sent me a text, Chris, and, you know, it's of an aluminum boat with a bow ripped out half of it. So we see all sorts of stuff, you know, out there. We've definitely, like I said, people used to have parties out there. So you'll drag mattresses off of islands that are all ripped and torn to pieces. It runs the gamut. You know, we certainly do collect a lot of fishing gear. And that said, you know, we try to partner up a lot with the fishing community. Maine Coast Fishermen's Association has been a great group to work with. We're not pointing any fingers, you know, they're out there just trying to do their work. Fishermen and women do not want to lose their gear. That is not something they want to have happen. So we're trying to collaborate more and work with them as well on kind of doing those cleanups to help out.
So tell us a bit more about your time as a captain.
I actually started off as crew here in Portland. We have two schooners. One's 88 feet. The other one is 72 feet. And then I started working for, it's called Portland Schooner Company, and I was sailing their John Alden design schooners. One was built in 1912. The other was built in, I think, 1924. Beautiful boats to sail on. I actually started as crew, did that for a couple months, and then started captaining. And they were licensed to take 49 passengers. We did day sails, 2-hour day sails with them. And a lot of that was sailing here around Portland Harbor. One of the neat things about Portland Harbor is right from the harbor, you can see, you know, as you get out of the harbor, you can see Portland Headlight. There's Bug Light. There's Spring Point Light. So you get right away three different lighthouses. There's three different forts that were built in the early 1900s. There's Fort Scammell, Fort Preble, Fort Gorgeous. So there's a lot of really neat things to look at. But it's also sailing with a lot of boat traffic. I think I mentioned earlier, but, you know, we would have ferry boats coming in and out. We would have the, you know, water taxis. We would have cruise ships coming in and out. And at one point, Portland Harbor used to be where I believe it was crude oil came in. So we'd get a lot of tankers as well as container ships coming in and out of. So it was a kind of a fun place to sail, but you really had to be aware of what's going on. And when I was captaining, it was usually a crew, myself and a crew of either two or three, depending on which vessel it was on board.
Yeah, sounds like you needed to have your wits about you, really.
But it was a lot of fun, you know, a lot of good, you have lots of good conversations with people. I think people just enjoy being out on the water and, you know, you kind of balance that act of having good conversations with people, telling them about what's going on in the area and definitely paying attention too to what's happening because you are responsible.
I've always wanted to have a captain's hat. Do you have a captain's hat?
I do not have a captain's hat. That would be kind of cool to have, though.
Yeah, not sure you can really describe yourself as a captain without a captain's hat.
I used to have my collared t-shirt used to say captain on. That's about as far as I got.
What? That's a question we haven't asked you, actually. What special gear do you have to wear as an oyster farmer? What's the getup like?
I would say it's very similar to... probably, you know, lobster fishing. So I have Grundens, I have rubber steel-toed boots that I wear. A lot of times, you know, like I said, it's pretty dirty work. You're constantly cleaning these. So for me, I do surface aquaculture. My oysters are in cages and bags that float on the surface. So I am constantly, this morning I was out there at 5:30 a.m. hauling bags out, trying to brush the bags because biofouling, if any, you know, boaters are listening, you know, you get growth on the bottom of your boat and that's got, anti-fouling paint on it. My oysters do not have any anti-fouling paint put on them. So marine growth tends to grow on them quite a bit. And one of our big jobs is constantly kind of cleaning so that water can flow over the oysters. The other big thing is oysters naturally want to grow together. That's why there used to be large oyster reefs. And so I have to constantly kind of shake my bags to keep the oysters from growing together. It also like chips the leading edge of it so that it'll cup up and you get a nice deep cup to your oyster. And that's how, as a farmer, you can kind of help to shape and what the oyster actually looks like.
So you're basically separating them out from their loved ones, though, aren't you, effectively?
Oh, I like to keep them close to their loved ones, just not connected, at the hip, shall we say.
You know what? And that's actually quite healthy, thinking about it.
Exactly. Be your own person and then have your others around you.
Yeah, you don't want to be growing out of your mom. That's weird, isn't it?
Exactly.
Oh, that's really cool. And what, for the uninitiated, what are the... peak seasons, like what time of year is best for your
eating oyster?
No, for growing them.
Okay. So typically they grow the most during the warmer months when there's just more nutrients in the water column. Basically here in Maine, the oysters will pretty much go dormant during the winter time. So come about December, when the water temp dips below, give or take, you know, anywhere, if it's like in that low 50s range, they start to go dormant. So I can actually sink them down to the bottom for the winter. But what I try to do is I try to cull, which is like separating out by size. So I will cull out my market size oysters. I'll keep those up on the surface for the winter time so I can still take them to market. And everything that's smaller, I'll just sink down to the bottom. And then I bring them back up in the springtime. This winter, it was, there was a pretty good cold snap. So I was having to break ice in order to kind of go out and grab my oysters and bring them in to then take them to market. But there's not a ton of work that goes into them in the wintertime, unless other than taking them to market.
Yeah. And how many are there working on your farm? Like, do you have other people that help you out as well outside of your family?
No, pretty much just us. You know, every once in a while, somebody will come out. But no, it's primarily me and whenever I can drag my wife and kiddos out with me.
Very cool. Yeah.
So when it comes to kind of starting in an oyster business, what would be some tips and what would be some things you need? I've looked at it in the past and I'm like, okay, well, number one, you need a boat.
Yeah.
And you need to know what you're doing with a boat. What other tips and advice would you get?
Yeah, so I would agree to those. We are actually, one of the members of our co-op, he actually doesn't have a boat. He has his oyster farm set up in an area where he can access it, you know, just by putting on some waders and he can go out and access most of his farm, obviously title dependent. But yeah, I think for the most part, you know, if you're somebody that really loves being on the water, it's a great thing. You know, it gets you out more than you normally would, right? So I'm boating, I'm out there kind of up until almost mid-December. And then again, starting up in kind of late March almost. So it definitely gets you out on the water more. In terms of what would I recommend? Definitely get in touch with, you know, it's always great to go out and check out somebody's farm. And then, you know, from there, I didn't have any, background in marine biology or anything like that. A good friend of mine had just started a year earlier and, you know, kind of, once again, I think I told you about that oyster math is funny math. He's like, oh, you can buy seed at, 5 cents or less, and you can sell it at $1 an oyster. And he's like, you know, it's just easy. And I'm like, oh, great. That said, there's a lot of work that goes into it, but it's just time and being able to, you know, enjoy being out on the water. For me, getting out in the morning and having some time when it's nice and peaceful and quiet, 5:30, 6 a.m. is a nice time to be on the water. So if anybody's interested in getting into it, I would say definitely do it, and feel free to reach out to, you know, different farmers up and down the coast. A lot of them are pretty open to talking about it.
More generally, what are your kind of tips for kind of budding entrepreneurs in general? So not necessarily on the sort of farming side of things, but actually getting your business out there and getting the message out there and making a success of it. What have you found to be the best sort of tips you could give people for that?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, it's funny. I don't think of myself as much of an entrepreneur. The oysters for me is very much kind of a side hobby. I've always had another full-time job, and at least the way that with oysters right now, I could grow a million oysters and sell all of them pretty much, you know, or 500,000. Like there's just a huge demand for them right now. So it would be hard for me to give a ton of entrepreneurial advice, only because I just don't see myself as one. I definitely see myself as somebody who loves being on the water, enjoys doing something that's good for the environment with growing oysters. But then, you know, obviously for me too, it's being, you know, I feel so fortunate to be working for an organization that, you know, is a nonprofit that I just love everything about the mission and what we do. So it's kind of one of those things where I'm like, yeah, you know, I can do that. And just on the side, be able to putter around and do some oyster work is kind of a nice thing.
One thing that I just find interesting about your bio is honestly how you went from boat to software completely outside of marine and then back to marine.
Yep.
So what exactly about the water brought you back? I mean, is it freedom? Is it the romantic nature of it all? Like, what is it?
Good question. So I never left boating. So even when I was doing the software for commercial real estate, you know, during the summer when I would take time off, we would, you know, I've always sailed. I've always had, you know, access to sailboats, the motorboats. So I was always doing it. It's just kind of like on my weekends, I would go and do it, right? And I would have my job. I think it's just that it was kind of how I grew up, was cruising along the coast of Maine. We had a good friend that had a Ted Hood 38 sailboat, and we used to sail that a lot in the summertime. I was always racing small sailboats as a kid too, between Opties, Blue Jays, 420s, JY15s, the whole nine. So I always kind of had that world. During the summer still now I race, it's called the Small Point One Design. It's a 19.5-foot wooden boat, Marconi rig, and, you know, main jib and spinnaker. And so I still race those on Saturdays. And so I never really left the water. It was just kind of that for me growing up, right? It was loving the water and then realizing, okay, I need to have a real job. I've got a wife and kids. I need to kind of make some money. And so that was when I started doing the software thing, which for a little while, luckily I was able to overlap it with still doing some captaining on the weekends and stuff before my kiddos got older. And so, yeah, so I feel like, as you said, Meryl, like it's always been that that's my happy place is being on the water.
You've done some big sailing trips. What's the biggest sailing trip you've ever done?
A good friend of mine and I, we left Maine a little bit late because we were trying to rapidly get a boat fixed up and ready to go. But we took an Endeavor 38 from Maine, sailed down the East Coast from Maine down to Fort Lauderdale. And we didn't leave until kind of just before Thanksgiving. So it was a little chilly when we left the Gulf of Maine in a snowstorm. kind of worked our way down to warmer latitudes. And then we ended up doing the Thorny Passage. So we sailed from Maine over to the Bahamas, kind of against the trades, but we were able to sail through the Bahamas. And then we hit up, we did Turks and Caicos, Puerto Rico, the US, the BVIs, we made it down as far as Dominica, and then we sailed back up to St. Martin, St. Martin to Bermuda, then Bermuda to home. And that was about a 7-month trip, which was a lot of fun. You know, it was literally pre kind of wife and kids and get out and go have some fun and realize like, hey, let's do this while we're young. And we were in our mid-20s at that point.
Now, getting into the marine industry in general, I personally felt that there's kind of a disconnect between leisure marine and the environment. Mm-hmm. And you have a unique perspective on that. You're one of the board of directors of the Maine Marine Trade Association. So how have you seen kind of this awareness shift happening over time?
That's a great question. Yeah. So I think, MMTA, the Maine Marine Trade Association, their executive director, Stacy, has really done a wonderful job of really trying to work with their members. And they've got a great group of members. And really, as you said, it's trying to focus on kind of our footprint, if you will, and realizing, that everything, has effects on stuff. And they've done a really great job between trying to, make sure with water quality and runoff and, looking into shrink wrap recycling and fiberglass recycling and how they can be doing, just realizing more of the environmental footprint and how we can kind of do better. And I think that the industry in general, is starting to, starting to make that shift. And I think it's great for me being able to be on the board just to try to, have those conversations. And I think everybody's very receptive to it. And it's just trying to really start to work through some of those processes that have been in place for a long time. And it's been great to work with Stacy and the whole group. And at least here in Maine, there's such a wonderful group of people and members of that organization.
So when it comes to, obviously, always be an optimist, but what do you see the biggest hurdles within the industry in terms of environmental conservation and that type of stuff?
Yeah, I really, it seems as though it's as technology evolves, right? So being able to have the capability to, really focus more on that shrink wrap recycling. Lots of boats here in New England get shrink wrapped, and it's a lot of plastic. And so it's one of those things where I think it's as the technology and the costs kind of start to come together more. I think that's where, I don't know if it's necessarily the biggest hurdle, but I think I think the technology is getting there, and then it's bringing the cost to make it so that it is affordable for people to actually be able to do it. I think there's a lot of people that want to go solar, but it's pretty expensive still. Or there's people want to kind of do the right thing. And I think it's just kind of bringing that price point so that they can afford to be able to do so. And that's probably one of the bigger hurdles that hopefully, and I think as a country, right, that we're able to help to be able to make that happen more.
In terms of the ecosystem of the ocean, I was reading in one of the articles that it wasn't overfishing that was the problem. It was more of there wasn't as many fisheries. What's your take on kind of the overall state of kind of the ocean and that side of things? I feel like it's still just like a giant mystery. Like no one, you can look at the water, but you can only get so far on it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think I tend to agree with you. I think that certainly, the government's trying to figure out ways to be able to make it so that it is sustainable, the fisheries. And I think they're certainly taking steps in the right direction. I think it's clearly here in Maine, I think it's tough on some of the fishermen with some of the regulations. But then again, it seems like most people are understanding that, the way that it was done was not sustainable. So, I agree with you, Meryl. I think it is a bit of a bit of a mystery. And I don't spend tons of time within that world, but getting to partner more with the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association and really trying to learn from them has been a really positive experience for me, just getting a better understanding of that world. And I've only just starting to dip my toes into that water, but it is really interesting to hear both sides of that one. And you probably all know, right? Like lobstering in Maine has been going on, for hundreds of years. And I think you know, their amount of catch keeps coming up, but they're a pretty self-regulated industry. So I think that that is an interesting model to see, you know, if that can be followed or replicated in other ways too.
So why did you go for oysters rather than lobsters?
Good question. Lobstering, it's really the only way you can get a lobster license here in Maine is basically if somebody else retires one. I mean, you can do a recreational 5-trap license, which means that you can fish 5 lobster traps. So it really wasn't much of an option for me. Basically, yeah, lobster licenses is they're pretty much handed down either within families and or, you know, if one gets retired, they'll issue a new one. But they keep it pretty well regulated amongst. So it's hard to get into it other than, you know, if I were to jump on a boat and be somebody's stern man, which would really kind of set my schedule a whole lot more than I had the ability to do. And that's why oystering was nice, because I could kind of work on the oyster farm when I had time.
Yeah. And do you make sorry to be the money centric one, but do you make more money selling lobsters or oysters?
Oh, I would say you probably make more money selling lobsters, although your overhead's also more too. You got to be paying for bait and fuel and gear. For oystering, you know, I have to buy the gear, which is an initial investment. But it's not crazy, because you can keep it kind of smaller, and then each year I buy my seed. But once again, that's not outlandishly expensive by any means. So it is something where, and I think this is why people are really getting into it, you know, you can actually start doing it, and you know, within 2 years you could actually start selling and making a little bit of money doing it.
So obviously you spend an awful lot of time, I don't know, is it knee deep in oysters? I don't know how deep
it is. but you
spend a lot of time up close and personal with these creatures. Do you have any favorite oyster facts about them as creatures?
You know, I mean, I think clearly the fact that they can filter 50 gallons of water a day is pretty impressive. You know, when you open up and you look into kind of the actually crack open an oyster and you look into them, so their actual the oyster biology, if you will. My wife's a bio teacher, so she geeks out on it a little bit more than I do. But you know, it's pretty neat to see all the different components, the gills of the oyster, the, you know, the heart, if you will, of the oyster. It's a living organism, so it is kind of neat to actually look into them and see.
Yeah, and how often do you actually eat oysters yourself?
I slurped a few last night.
Do you have any recommendations for how you should be having your oysters? I know you generally just have them raw, don't you? But I'm sure that can't be the only way.
We do eat them raw. I was actually, a friend of mine had us over and he said, you know, bring some oysters and we'll do them. And he ended up grilling them and putting some like lemon butter and different stuff on them and did them on the grill. And it was delicious. I've certainly
that
had
sounds
them.
Amazing.
Yeah. With some vignettes as well. I've had oyster po' boys once with somebody took some of my oysters and did that and, you know, shared some with me. So I've had them a few different ways. I typically am pretty lazy, so I'll just shuck them and slurp them. But that said, there are lots of good things that you can put on them to make them taste even yummier.
Because they are a bit of an acquired taste, aren't they? And certainly they do crop up at boat shows now and again. And sometimes it feels like a bit of a rite of passage, you know. you have to eat the oyster to prove that you're up for it.
For sure.
So very cool. And I'm actually doing a charity challenge at the moment where I'm not eating any food, really very much food at all. So I'm quite tempted by the sound of those grilled oysters, to be honest.
There you go.
So maybe when I finish the charity challenge, I'll just go off and eat a lot of oysters.
Yeah, exactly. Get lots of good protein in your system.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've certainly learned a huge amount about oysters. I don't know about you, Meryl.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly going to go get some oysters after we're done with this interview. So kind of one of the final questions I got is, you know, you're this new breed of man, the ecological man. So what is it that gets you up every single day? You know, what is your driving force with everything that you're doing with the oysters and the Maine Island Trail Association and even the Marine Trade Association?
Yeah. So I think I'm at that point, Meryl, where I am, you know, 41 years old and doing what I absolutely love to do. So, you know, I always say to people, they're like, how things going? And my answer is typically busy, but doing all good things. You know, obviously Maine Island Trail is kind of my number one in that it's just the best organization, aid to work for. Our staff of 10 are some of the best people I've ever worked with. Everybody is extremely passionate about what we do, love being out on the water. So I get a ton of fulfillment out of my job here because I'm constantly making, you know, establishing relationships with, you know, be it businesses and just people up and down the coast of Maine, which I love Maine. I grew up spending my summers here. As I mentioned at the beginning, I'm actually from Vermont, but spending summers here. So I think, you know, what gets me up in the morning is just realizing how lucky I am. I have, you know, a wonderful wife. I've got two healthy kids that are 10 and 8, and I absolutely love working for Mida. And, you know, the oyster farm is just a fun thing that can keep me out of trouble and you know, brings in a few bucks and gets me out on the water even more. So I just feel very fortunate to be able to have kind of all these different pieces in place.
Well, Jordy, it was amazing talking to you. And hearing all these different insights and different experiences that you've had, really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you both, Meryl and Georgia. It was really fun to talk to you, and thanks for the time.
No problem at all. I'm going to go set up my oyster farm now.
Yeah, sounds good. Come on over and check mine out if you ever want to.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Meryl, when you're sailing up to Maine this summer, you got to swing up the New Meadows.
Well, I am certainly going to bring that up as a date idea. Be like, oh, I got an oyster connect. I think the girlfriend would fall for that one.
Yeah, definitely, man. You gotta do it. That's for sure. No, this is good. I hope it was helpful, and I'm glad we were able to do it. So thank you.
Check back every Tuesday for our latest episode and be sure to like, share and subscribe to ShipShape.pro.